when he was 10 or 11 years old and a B student. His father, a detail-oriented insurance executive, had grown so frustrated with his sloppy schoolwork that he handed his son The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and told him to copy a few pages exactly as Mark Twain had written them. Thaler tried, seriously. I did it over and over, kicking and screaming. Each time his father found errors, missing words, missing commas. The quotation marks in an exchange between Tom and Aunt Polly confounded him. Looking back on it, he could see that his problem was more than a lack of effort. He was probably mildly dyslexic, but people just assumed he was either careless or lazy or both. And so he began to think of himself this way, too. Economics just then wasn't perhaps the ideal place for people who were easily bored and had trouble with details. Thaler had gone from college straight to graduate school mainly because his father's life had persuaded him that business careers were mind-crushingly boring and that he had no ability to work for someone else. He couldn't think of what else to do but to go to graduate school, and he picked economics because it seemed kind of practical. Only then did he discover that the field placed a terrifying premium on both precision and mathematical ability, to the point where it seemed that the only people who were allowed to make jokes in their journal articles were the guys who were best at math. By the time Thaler arrived at the University of Rochester's Graduate School of Management, he sat at some distance from his own field and from his fellow graduate students. I was more interesting than them, and not as good at math, he said. What was I good at? It was at finding things that were interesting. He wrote his thesis about why the infant mortality rate in the United States was twice as high for black as for white populations. Controlling for all the obvious variables, education and income of the parents, whether the baby was born in a hospital, and so on, he explained only half the difference. He was left with what seemed an unsolvable puzzle. I tried and failed to explain it, he said. I could have made it more interesting if I had had more confidence. The economics profession responded by rejecting him for every university job he applied for. He settled for a job with a consulting firm. Then, just as he set out on a new path in life, the firm closed an office and let him go. At the age of 27, broke and unemployed, with a wife and two little kids, Thaler begged the head of the Rochester School of Management for a job, and the man gave him a temporary one-year gig teaching cost-benefit analysis to business school students. Back in school, he set out to write another dissertation. He found another interesting question. How much is a human life worth? He also found a clever way to approach the problem. He compared the salaries for risky jobs, coal miner, logger, skyscraper window washer, to the life expectancy of the people who did them. From the data, he backed out what Americans needed to be paid to accept an expected reduction in their lifespan. If you could calculate what people needed to be paid to accept a 1% chance of being killed on the job, you could, in theory, work out what you'd need to pay them to accept a 100% chance of being killed on the job. The number he came up with was $1.4 million in 2016 dollars. Later, he'd think of his methods as a little silly. Do we really think people make this decision rationally? But older, more successful economists were happy to assume that, say, America's coal miners made some inner calculation of the value of their lives and charged accordingly. The paper secured Thaler a full-time job, without tenure, at the Rochester Graduate School of Management. But it was while he was trying to calculate the value of a human life that he began to feel uneasy with economic theory. He'd given questionnaires to subjects that asked them a hypothetical question. If they had been exposed to a virus and knew there was a 1 in 1,000 chance that they had contracted a fatal disease, how much would they pay for the drug to cure it? Because he was an economist, he knew that there was more than one way to ask the question, so he also asked people, how much would you need to be paid to be exposed to a 1 in 1,000 chance of getting the same fatal disease? Economic theory said the two numbers should be the same. Whatever you were willing to pay to rid yourself of a 1 in 1,000 chance of dying, it should be the same as the sum you needed to be paid to expose yourself to a 1 in 1,000 chance of dying. That number was the value you assigned to a 1 in 1,000 chance of losing your life. People whose lives were even hypothetically on the line didn't feel that way. The answers people gave were orders of magnitudes apart, said Thaler. People would say they would pay $10,000 for the cure, but would need to be paid $1 million to be exposed to the virus. Thaler thought that was really interesting. He told his thesis advisor about his findings. Stop wasting your time with questionnaires and start doing real economics, said his advisor. Instead, Thaler began to keep a list. On the list were a lot of irrational things people do that economists claim that they don't do because economists presume that people are rational. At the top of the list was their willingness to pay 100 times more to avoid a 1 in 1,000 chance of being infected with an incurable disease than they were for the cure for that same disease after they already had a 1 in 1,000 chance of having it. Thaler may not have felt all that sure of himself, but he was quick to see that others shouldn't feel so sure of themselves either. And he noticed that when he had his fellow economists to dinner, they filled up on cashews, which meant they had less appetite for the meal. More to the point, he noticed that they tended to be relieved when he removed the cashew nuts so they didn't ruin their dinners. The idea that it could make you better off to reduce your choices, that idea was alien to economics, he said. After he and a friend were given tickets to a basketball game in Buffalo, then decided it wasn't worth driving through a snowstorm to watch it, his friend said, "But if we paid for those tickets, we'd be going." An economist would see the tickets as sunk cost. You don't go to a game you don't want to go to just because you paid for the tickets. Why add to your misery? I said, "Come on. Don't you know about sunk cost?" recalled Thaler. His friend was a computer scientist and didn't know about sunk cost. After Thaler explained the concept, his friend just looked at him and said, "Oh, that's just a bunch of bullshit." Thaler's list grew quickly. A lot of the items on it fell into a bucket that he eventually would label the endowment effect. The endowment effect was a psychological idea with economic consequences. People attached some strange extra value to whatever they happened to own simply because they owned it, and so proved surprisingly reluctant to part with their possessions, or endowments, even when trading them made economic sense. But in the beginning, Thaler wasn't thinking in categories. "At the time, I'm just collecting a list of stupid things people do," he said. Why were people so slow to sell vacation homes that, if they hadn't bought them in the first place and were offered them now, they would never buy? Why were NFL teams so reluctant to trade their draft picks when it was obvious that they could often get more than the players were worth in exchange? Why were investors so reluctant to sell stocks that had fallen in value, even when they admitted that they would never buy those stocks at their current market prices? There was no end of things people did that economic theory had trouble explaining. When you start looking for the endowment effect, Thaler said, you see it everywhere. His feelings about his own field were not so very different from his feelings for Monopoly as a kid. It was boring, and unnecessarily so. Economics was meant to be the study of an aspect of human nature, but it had ceased to pay attention to human nature. Thinking about this stuff was way more interesting than doing economics, he said. When he called his observations to the attention of his fellow economists, they weren't interested. The first thing they'd always say was, "Of course we know people make mistakes every now and then, but the mistakes are random, and they'll wash out in the market," recalled Thaler. Thaler no longer believed that. His list and the impulse to create it did not win him friends in the University of Rochester's Department of Economics or its business school. "He had enemies, and he's not awfully good at mollifying enemies," said Tom Russell, a fellow economics professor at Rochester. "If you tell an academic to his face, you've just said something really stupid. Okay, the big ones might say, 'How is it stupid?' But the little ones just store it." The University of Rochester denied Thaler tenure. His future was hazy when, in 1976, he attended a conference on how to value a human life. When he heard of Thaler's curious interests, another conference attendee suggested that Thaler read Kahneman and Tversky's article in Science that sought to explain why people did stupid things. Thaler went home and found Judgment Under Uncertainty in an old copy of Science. He couldn't believe his own excitement as he read it. He went and pulled all the other articles and other publications written by Kahneman and Tversky. "I have vivid memories of running from one article to another," says Thaler, "as if I have discovered the secret pot of gold. For a while, I wasn't sure why I was so excited. Then I realized they had one idea, which was systematic bias. If people could be systematically wrong, their mistakes couldn't be ignored. The irrational behavior of the few would not be offset by the rational behavior of the many. People could be systematically wrong, and so markets could be systematically wrong, too." Thaler got someone to send him a draft of value theory. He instantly saw it for what it was, a truck packed with psychology that might be driven into inner sanctums of economics and exploded. The logic in the paper was awesome, overpowering. What soon would be known as prospect theory explained most of the items on Thaler's list, in a language economists could understand. There were items on Thaler's list that prospect theory did not address. Self-control was the big one, but that didn't matter. The paper blew a hole in economic theory for psychology to enter. "That really is the magic of the paper," said Thaler, "showing you could do it. Math with psychology in it." That paper was what an economist would call proof of existence. It captured so much of human nature. Till then, Thaler had felt his place in economics to be as uncertain as his ability to copy Tom Sawyer. "If they didn't exist, I don't know if I would have stayed in the field," he said. After finishing the collected works of the Israeli psychologists, he had a new feeling. "The way it feels to me," he said, "is that there were certain ideas that I was put on this earth to think, and now I can think them." He would begin, he decided, by turning his list into an article. But even before he did, he found a mailing address for the Department of Psychology at Hebrew University and wrote a letter to Amos Tversky. It was almost always to Amos that the economists wrote. They understood him. Amos's insistently logical mind was much like their own, but somehow better. They could see his genius. To most economists, Danny's mind was a mystery. Richard Zeckhauser, an economist at Harvard who became friends with Amos, spoke for his entire field when he said, "My impression of the way they worked on a paper is that they walked around and let Danny do a variety of things. Guess what, Amos? I went to buy a car and I offered 38 grand, and the salesman said 38.9, and I said yes. Did I do a good job?" And Amos would say, "Let's write that up." The economist's view of the collaboration was that Amos Tversky had set out, like an anthropologist, to study an alien tribe of beings less rational than himself, and his tribe was Danny. "I share your feeling that such behavior is in some sense unwise or erroneous, but this does not mean that it does not occur," Amos wrote, to an American economist who complained about the description of human nature implied by value theory. "A theory of vision cannot be faulted for predicting optical illusions. Similarly, a descriptive theory of choice cannot be rejected on the grounds that it predicts irrational behavior if the behavior in question is, in fact, observed." Danny, for his part, claimed that it wasn't until 1976 that he woke up to the effects their theory might have on a field he knew nothing about. His awakening came when Amos handed him a paper written by an economist. The paper opened, "The agent of economic theory is rational, selfish, and his tastes do not change." The economists at Hebrew University were in the building next door, but Danny hadn't paid any attention to their assumptions about human nature. "To me, the idea that they really believed in it, that this is really their worldview, was incredible," he said. "It's the worldview in which if people tip in a restaurant to which they will never return, it counts as a puzzle." It was a worldview that took it as given that the only way to change people's behavior was to change their financial incentives. The idea of it struck him as so bizarre that he could scarcely bring himself to engage with it directly. To Danny, the whole idea of proving that people weren't rational felt a bit like proving that people didn't have fur. Obviously, people were not rational in any meaningful sense of that term. He and Amos wanted to avoid getting into an argument about the rationality of man. That argument would only distract people from the phenomenon they were uncovering. They preferred to reveal man's nature and let man decide what he was. Their next task, they saw, was to buff and polish value theory for publication. They both worried that someone would find an obvious contradiction, some allay paradox-like observation that would render their theory dead on arrival. They'd spend 3 years doing very little else but searching the theory for internal contradictions. "In those 3 years, we did not discuss anything of genuine interest," said Danny. Danny's interest ended with the psychological insights. Amos was obsessed with the business of using the insights to create a structure. What Amos saw, perhaps more clearly than Danny, was that the only way to force the world to grapple with their insights into human nature was to embed them in a theory. That theory needed to explain and predict behavior better than existing theory, but it also needed to be expressed in symbolic logic. "What made the theory important and what made it viable were completely different," said Danny years later. "Science is a conversation, and you have to compete for the right to be heard. And the competition has its rules. And the rules, oddly enough, or that you are tested on formal theory. After they finally sent a draft of their paper to the economics journal Econometrica, Danny was perplexed by the editor's response. I was kind of hoping he'd say, loss aversion is a really cool idea. He said, no, I like the math. I was sort of shattered. By 1976, purely for marketing purposes, they changed their title to prospect theory. The idea was to give the theory a completely distinct name that would have no associations whatsoever, said Danny. When you say prospect theory, no one knows what you're talking about. We thought, who knows? It may turn out to be influential. And if it is, we don't want it to be confused with anything else. In all of this, they were slowed dramatically by the turmoil in Danny's life. By 1974, he'd moved out of his house and was living apart from his wife and children. A year later, he left the marriage and flew to London to meet the psychologist Anne Treisman to formally declare my love. She reciprocated. By the fall of 1975, Amos was clearly weary of the inevitable fallout. It is hard to overestimate the amount of time and the amount of emotional and mental energy that is consumed with such affairs, he wrote to his friend Paul Slovak. In October 1975, Danny flew to England again, this time to see Anne in Cambridge and to travel with her to Paris. He was at once in a totally uncharacteristic state of elation and worried about the effect of his new relationship with Anne on his old one with Amos. In Paris, he found waiting what appeared to be a letter from Amos. But opening it, he at first found only a draft of what would become prospect theory. Danny took the absence of any personal note as a subtle message from Amos. Sitting with his new love in the world's capital of romance, Danny sat down and wrote what amounted to a love letter to Amos. Dear Amos, it began. When I came to Paris, I found an envelope from you. I pulled out your manuscript, but there was no letter with it. And I told myself that Amos is very angry with me, and not without reason. After dinner, I was looking for a used envelope to send this back to you, and I found your envelope, and then saw your letter inside. We were late for dinner, and I just glanced to see how you finish it, and I saw the words, yours as ever, and I had goosebumps from emotion. He went on to write that he'd explained to Anne that he could never have achieved on his own what he had achieved with Amos, and that the new paper they were working on was yet another step. This is for me the greatest moment in a relationship which I see as one of the peaks of my life, he wrote. Then he added, I was yesterday at Cambridge, and I spoke to them about our work on value theory. The enthusiasm is almost embarrassing. I concluded with a discussion of the early stages of the isolation effect, and they responded to that especially. In general, they gave me the feeling that I'm one of the world's greats. They were trying so hard to impress me that I reached the conclusion that maybe the time has come for me to be free of the need to impress others. In some strange way, as they approached their moment of greatest public triumph, their collaboration remained a private affair, a gamble with no context. As long as we stayed in Israel, the whole idea of what the world thought of us didn't occur to us, said Danny. We benefited from our isolation. That isolation depended on them being together, in the same room, behind a closed door. That door was now cracking open. Anne was British. She was also a Gentile and the mother of four children, one of whom had Down syndrome. There were about 16 different reasons she couldn't or wouldn't move to Israel, and if Anne wasn't moving to Israel, it followed that Danny would need to leave. Danny and Amos scrambled and found a temporary solution in 1977 by heading off together from Hebrew University on sabbatical to Stanford University, where Anne might join them. But a few months after their arrival in the United States, Danny announced that he planned to marry Anne and stay. He forced Amos to make a decision about what to do about their relationship. It was now Amos's turn to sit down and write an emotional letter. Danny was messy in a way that Amos could never be messy, even if he wanted to be. Amos had wanted to be a poet when he was a boy. He'd wound up a scientist. Danny was a poet who somehow happened to have become a scientist. Danny felt some obvious desire to be more like Amos. Amos, too, harbored some less obvious desire to be more like Danny. Amos was a genius, but he needed Danny, and he knew it. The letter Amos wrote was to his close friend Gidon Chapsky, the rector of Hebrew University. Dear Giddy, it began, the decision to remain here in the United States is the most difficult decision I have ever made. I cannot ignore my desire to bring to a completion, at least partially, the joint work with Danny. I just cannot accept the idea that the joint work of years would come to naught, and that we will not be able to complete the ideas we have." Amos went on to explain that he planned to accept a chaired professorship offered to him by Stanford University. He knew full well that everyone in Israel would be shocked and angry. "If Danny leaves Israel, it is a personal tragedy," a Hebrew university official had said to him not long before. "If you leave, it is a national tragedy." Until Amos actually left, his friends found it unthinkable that he would live any place but Israel. Amos was Israel, and Israel was Amos. Even his American wife was upset. Barbara had fallen in love with Israel, its intensity, its sense of community, its disinterest in small talk. She now thought of herself as more Israeli than American. "I had done so much work to become Israeli," she said. "I didn't want to stay in the States." I said to Amos, "How can I start over?" He said, "You'll manage." Chapter 11, The Rules of Undoing. In the late 1970s, not long after he'd become superintendent of the Massachusetts Mental Health Center, Miles Schur realized he had a problem. The center was a teaching hospital for Harvard Medical School, where Schur was Bullard Professor of Psychiatry. Newly installed in administration, he found himself faced with a decision, whether to promote a medical researcher named J. Allen Hobson. It shouldn't have been that hard. In a series of famous papers, Hobson had landed body blows on the Freudian idea that dreams arose from unconscious desires by showing that they actually came from a part of the brain that had nothing to do with desire. He'd proven that the timing and the length of dreams were regular and predictable, which suggested that dreams had less to say about a person's psychological state than about his nervous system. Among other things, Hobson's research suggested that people who paid psychoanalysts to find meaning in their unconscious states were wasting their money. Hobson was changing people's understanding of what happened to the human brain during sleep, but he wasn't doing it alone. That was Miles Schur's problem. Hobson hadn't written his famous papers on dreams by himself, but with a partner named Robert McCarley. "It was very difficult to campaign for promotion for people who did their work collaboratively," said Schur, "because the system is based on the individual. It was always, what did this person do to change the field?" Schur wanted to promote Hobson, but he had to argue the case before a skeptical committee. "They basically didn't want to promote anyone," said Schur. Resisting the case for Hobson, committee members asked Schur if he could demonstrate exactly how much Hobson had contributed to his partnership with McCarley. "They asked me which one of them did what," recalled Schur. "And so I went to them," Hobson and McCarley, "and asked, which one of you did what? And they said, which one of us did what? We have no idea. It was a joint product." Schur pushed the collaborators a bit until he realized that they really meant it. They had no idea who deserved credit for which idea. "It was really interesting," said Schur. So interesting that Schur decided there might be a book in it. He set out to find fertile pairs, people who had been together for at least 5 years and produced interesting work. By the time he was done, he had interviewed a comedy duo, two concert pianists who had started performing together because one of them had stage fright, two women who wrote mysteries under the name Emma Lathan, and a famous pair of British nutritionists, McCants and Whittison, who were so tightly linked that they dropped their first names from the jackets of their books. "They were huffy about the idea that dark bread was more nutritious than white bread," recalled Schur. "They had produced the research that it wasn't so in 1934, so why didn't people stop fooling around with the idea?" Just about every work couple that Schur called were intrigued enough by their own relationships to want to talk about them. The only exceptions were a mean pair of physicists and, after flirting with participating, the British ice dancers Torval and Dean. Among those who agreed to sit down with Miles Schur were Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman. Schur found Danny and Amos together in August 1983 in Anaheim, California, where they were attending the American Psychological Association meeting. Danny was now 49 and Amos 46. They spoke with Schur together for several hours and then for several hours more separately. They walked Miles Schur through the history of the collaboration, starting with their early excitement. "In the beginning, we were able to answer a question that had not been asked," Amos told him. we were able to take psychology out of the contrived laboratory and address the topic from the experiences all around us. Trying to pin them down on the question they thought they were answering, Shore asked if their work fed into the new and growing field of artificial intelligence. "You know, not really," said Amos. "We study natural stupidity instead of artificial intelligence." The Harvard psychiatrist thought that Danny and Amos had a lot in common with other successful pairs, the way they had created what amounted to an exclusive private club of two, for example. "They were crazy about each other and not indiscriminate," said Shore. "They were not generally crazy about other people. They hated editors." As with some of the other fertile pairs, the partnership had created strains on their other close relationships. "The collaboration has put a lot of pressure on my marriage," Danny confessed. Like the other pairs, they had lost any sense of individual contribution. "You ask who did what?" said Danny. "We didn't know at the time, not clearly. It was beautiful not knowing." Shore thought that both Amos and Danny realized, or seemed to realize, how much they needed each other. "There are geniuses who work on their own," said Danny. "I'm not a genius. Neither is Tversky. Together, we are exceptional." What set Amos and Danny apart from the 19 other couples Shore had interviewed for his book was their willingness to speak about the problems in their relationship. "When I asked about conflicts, most people just ignored it," said Shore. "A number didn't want to admit there was any conflict. Not Amos and Danny, or at any rate, not Danny." "It's been difficult since I got married and since we moved to this continent," he confessed. Amos remained evasive, and yet great chunks of Shore's conversation with Danny and Amos wound up being about the many troubles they'd had since leaving Israel 6 years earlier. With Amos in the room, Danny complained at length about how different the public perception of the collaboration was from its reality. "I am perceived as attending him, which is not the case," he said, less to Shore than to Amos. "I clearly lose by the collaboration. There is a quality that is clearly contributed by you. Formal analysis is not my strength, and it shows up very distinctly in our work. My contributions are less unique." Amos spoke at less length about how the blame for their unequal status fell squarely on other people. "The credit business is very hard," said Amos. "There is a lot of wear and tear, and the outside world isn't helpful to collaborations. There is constant poking, and people decide that one person gets the short end of the stick. It's one of the rules of balance, and joint collaboration is an unbalanced structure. It is just not a stable structure. People aren't happy with it." Alone with the Harvard psychiatrist, Danny said more. He hinted that he didn't believe the outside world was entirely responsible for the problems in their relationship. "The spoils of academic success, such as they are, eventually one person gets all of it or gets a lot of it," he said. "That's an unkindness built in. Tversky cannot control this, though I wonder whether he does as much to control it as he should." Then he came straight out with his own feelings about Amos getting the lion's share of the glory for the work they had done together. "I am very much in his shadow in a way that is not representative of our interaction," he said. "It induces a certain strain. There is envy. It's just disturbing. I hate the feeling of envy. I am maybe saying too much now." Shore left the interview feeling that Amos and Danny had just come through a rough patch, but that the worst lay behind them. Their openness about their problems he took as a good sign. They hadn't exactly been fighting during their interview. Their attitude toward conflict was just different than that of the other couples he had spoken with. "They played the Israeli card," said Shore. "We're Israeli, so we yell at each other." Amos especially sounded optimistic that he and Danny would continue to work together as much as they had. It helped, Danny and Amos agreed, that the American Psychological Association had just honored both of them with its Distinguished Scientific Contribution Award. "I have lived in some fear that he might get it alone," Danny confessed to Shore. "That would have been a disaster, and I couldn't have coped very elegantly." The award had eased some pain, or so it seemed to Miles Shore. As it happened, Shore never wrote his book about fertile pairs, but years later he sent Danny an audio tape of their conversation. "I listened to it," Danny said, "and it is absolutely clear from it that we are finished." In late 1977, after Danny had told him that he wasn't returning to Israel, word spread through academia that Amos Tversky might leave too. The job market for college professors typically moves slowly and with great reluctance, but in this instance it leapt into action. It was as if an especially deliberate fat man watching TV on his couch suddenly realized that his house was on fire. Harvard University quickly offered Amos tenure, though it took them a few weeks to throw in an assistant professorship for Barbara. The University of Michigan, which had the advantage of sheer size, scrambled to find 4 tenured professorships, and, by making places for Danny, Ann, and Barbara, also snag Amos. The University of California at Berkeley, which left Danny with the clear impression when he made overtures that he was too old to be hired, prepared to offer a job to Amos, but no place moved quite so dramatically as Stanford. The psychologist Lee Ross, a rising star in the Stanford faculty, led the charge. He knew that the big public American universities who wanted Amos might, in the bargain, offer jobs to Barbara and Danny and Ann. Stanford was smaller and didn't have 4 jobs to offer. "We figured there were 2 things we could do that those schools might not," said Ross. "One was to make the offer early, and the other was to make it fast. We wanted to convince him to come to Stanford, and the best way we can convince him to come is to show him how quickly we can act." What happened next was, Ross believed, unprecedented in the history of the American university. The morning he learned Amos was on the market, he convened Stanford's psychology department. "I was supposed to present the case for Amos," said Ross. "I said, 'I'm going to tell you a classic Yiddish story. There's a guy, an eligible bachelor, a happy bachelor. The matchmaker comes to him and says, "Listen, I have for you a match." "Ah, I'm not so sure," says the bachelor. "She's really special," says the matchmaker. "What, is she beautiful?" asked the bachelor. "Beautiful. She looks like Sophia Loren, only younger." "What, does she have family money?" asked the bachelor. "Money. She's an heiress to the Rothschild fortune." "Then she must be a dope," says the bachelor. "A dope. She's been nominated for Nobel Prizes in both physics and chemistry." "I accept," says the bachelor. To which the matchmaker replies, "Good. We have half a match." Ross told the Stanford faculty, "After I tell you about Amos, you will say, 'I accept.' And I will say, 'I'm sorry to tell you, we have half a match.'" Even to Ross, it was unclear that the sales pitch was necessary. Everyone who came across the work congratulated themselves on their own good judgment and insight in appreciating the work, said Ross. But nobody didn't get it. That same day, the Stanford psychology department went to the Stanford president and said, "We have none of the usual paperwork. No recommendations or anything else. Just trust us." Stanford made Amos an offer of lifetime employment that afternoon. Amos would later tell people that in choosing between Harvard and Stanford, he imagined the regret he would experience at each. At Harvard, he'd regret passing up Palo Alto's weather and living conditions and resent the commute. At Stanford, he'd regret, and only briefly, not being able to say he was a Harvard professor. If it occurred to him or anyone else that Amos, to be Amos, needed Danny close at hand, he didn't show it. Stanford showed not the slightest interest in Danny. "There's a practical issue," said Ross. "Do you want 2 guys doing the same thing?" And the cold fact is, we got the full benefit of Danny and Amos just by hiring Amos. Danny would have loved for them all to go to Michigan, but Amos clearly had no interest in any place but Harvard or Stanford. After Harvard and Stanford had ignored him, and Berkeley had let him know that he would not be offered a job, Danny accepted a position beside Anne at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. He and Amos agreed they would take turns flying to visit each other every other weekend. Danny was still floating on air. We were on such a high from having finished prospect theory and embarked on framing that we must have felt pretty invulnerable, he said. There was not a shadow between us at the time. He watched Amos give the traditional job application talk at Stanford, after Stanford had made him what was likely the fastest job offer in its history. Amos presented prospect theory. "I noticed that I felt nothing but pride for him," said Danny. "I noticed it because envy would have been natural." When Danny left Palo Alto for Vancouver for the start of the 1978-1979 academic year, he was even more aware than usual of the serendipity of life. His 2 children were now on the other side of the world, along with his old lab, a department full of former colleagues, and a society to which he once assumed he belonged. He had left behind in Israel a ghost of himself. "The background to what I was thinking was that I had just changed my life," he said. "I changed my wife. The counterfactuals were with me all the time. I was constantly comparing my life to what it might have been." In this curious state of mind, he found his thoughts settling on a nephew, Ilan. Ilan had been a 21-year-old navigator in the back of an Israeli fighter during the Yom Kippur War. After the war, he had sought out Danny and asked him to listen to an audio tape he had kept from it. He'd been in the back seat of the fighter when an Egyptian MiG got behind them, locking in for a kill. On the tape you could hear Ilan scream at his pilot, "Break! Break! Break! He's on our tail!" As Ilan played the tape, Danny noticed that the young man was shaking. For some reason, he wanted his uncle to hear what had happened to him. Ilan had survived the war, but a year and a half later, in March 1975, 5 days before he was to be released from service, he was killed. Blinded by a flare, his pilot had flown upside down straight into the ground. They thought they were rising when in fact they were falling. It wasn't an original mistake. Pilots in flight often became disoriented. The inner ear wasn't designed for a gravity-defying chamber pitching and rolling at 650 miles an hour, a mile above the Earth's surface, any more than the mind was designed to calculate the probabilities of complex situations. It had evolved to stabilize people on their own 2 feet. People who flew airplanes were susceptible to sensory illusions, which was why a pilot without an instrument rating who flew into clouds had an average life expectancy of 178 seconds. After Alon's death, Danny couldn't help but notice the urge in those who loved him to mentally undo his plane crash. Many of the sentences that came from their lips might just as well have started with the words, "If only." If only Ilan had been released from the Air Force a week earlier. If only he'd taken charge after his pilot was blinded by that flare. People's minds coped with loss by drifting onto fantasy paths, where loss never occurred. But this drifting, Danny noticed, wasn't random. There appeared to be constraints on the mind when it created alternatives to reality. If Ilan had still had a year of service remaining when his plane crashed, no one would have said, "If only he had been released a year ago." No one said, "If only the pilot had the flu that day," or, "If only Ilan's plane had been grounded for mechanical problems." For that matter, no one said, "If only Israel had not had an air force." Any of those counterfactuals would have saved his life, but none of them came to the minds of those who loved him. There were, of course, a million ways that any plane crash might have been avoided, but people seemed to consider only a few of them. There were patterns in the fantasies that people created to undo his nephew's tragedy, and they resembled patterns in the alternative versions of his own life that played out in Danny's mind. Soon after his arrival in Vancouver, Danny asked Amos to send him any notes that he'd kept from their discussions about regret. In Jerusalem, they'd spent more than a year talking about the rules of regret. They'd been interested chiefly in people's anticipation of the unpleasant emotion, and how this anticipation might alter the choices they made. Now Danny wanted to explore regret and other emotions from the opposite direction. He wanted to study how people undid events that had already happened. Both he and Amos could see how such a study might feed into their work on both judgment and decision-making. There is nothing in the framework of decision theory that would prohibit the assignment of utilities to states of frustrated hope, relief, or regret, if these are identified as important aspects of the experience of consequences, they wrote, in what amounted to a memo to themselves. However, there is a reason to suspect a major bias against the acknowledgement of the true impact of such states on experience. It is expected of mature individuals that they should feel the pain or pleasure that is appropriate to the circumstances without undue contamination by unrealized possibilities. Danny now had an idea that there might be a fourth heuristic, to add to availability, representativeness, and anchoring. The simulation heuristic, he'd eventually call it, and it was all about the power of unrealized possibilities to contaminate people's minds. As they moved through the world, people ran simulations of the future. What if I say what I think instead of pretending to agree? What if they hit it to me and the grounder goes through my legs? What happens if I say no to his proposal instead of yes? They based their judgments and decisions in part on these imagined scenarios. And yet, not all scenarios were equally easy to imagine. They were constrained, much in the way that people's minds seem constrained when they undid some tragedy. Discover the mental rules that the mind obeyed when it undid events after they had occurred, and you might find, in the bargain, how it simulated reality before it occurred. Alone in Vancouver, Danny was gripped by his new interest in the distance between worlds, the world that existed and worlds that might have come to pass but never did. Much of the work he and Amos had done was about finding structure where no one had ever thought to look for it. Here was another chance to do that. He wanted to investigate how people created alternatives to reality by undoing reality. He wanted, in short, to discover the rules of the imagination. With one eye on a prickly colleague in his new department named Richard Tees, Danny sat down and created a vignette for a new experiment. Mr. Crane and Mr. Tees are scheduled to leave the airport on different flights at the same time. They traveled from town in the same limousine, were caught in the same traffic jam, and arrived at the airport 30 minutes after the scheduled departure time of their flights. Mr. Crane is told that his flight left on time. Mr. Tees is told that his flight was delayed and just left 5 minutes ago. Who is more upset? The situation of the two men was identical. Both expected to miss their planes, and both had. And yet 96% of the subjects to whom Danny put the question said that Mr. Tees was more upset. Everyone seemed to understand that reality wasn't the only source of frustration. The emotion was also fed by its proximity to another reality, how close Mr. Tees came to making his flight. The only reason for Mr. Tees to be more upset is that it was more possible for him to reach his flight, Danny wrote, in notes for a talk on the subject. There is an Alice in Wonderland quality to such examples, with their odd mixture of fantasy and reality. If Mr. Crane is capable of imagining unicorns, and we expect he is, why does he find it relatively difficult to imagine himself avoiding a 30-minute delay, as we suggest he does? Evidently, there are constraints on the freedom of fantasy. It was those constraints that Danny set out to investigate. He wanted to understand better what he was now calling counterfactual emotions, or the feelings that spurred people's minds to spin alternative realities in order to avoid the pain of the emotion. Regret was the most obvious counterfactual emotion, but frustration and envy shared regret's essential trait. The emotions of unrealized possibility, Danny called them in a letter to Amos. These emotions could be described using simple math. Their intensity, Danny wrote, was a product of two variables, the desirability of the alternative and the possibility of the alternative. Experiences that led to regret and frustration were not always easy to undo. Frustrated people needed to undo some feature of their environment, while regretful people needed to undo their own actions. The basic rules of undoing, however, apply alike to frustration and regret, he wrote. They require a more or less plausible path leading to the alternative state. Envy was different. Envy did not require a person to exert the slightest effort to imagine a path to the alternative state. The availability of the alternative appears to be controlled by a relation of similarity between oneself and the target of envy. To experience envy, it is sufficient to have a vivid image of oneself in another person's shoes. It is not necessary to have a plausible scenario of how one came to occupy those shoes. Envy, in some strange way, required no imagination. Danny spent the first several months of his separation from Amos with these strange and beguiling thoughts. In early January 1979, he wrote Amos a memo titled, The State of the Undoing Project. I've spent some time making up disasters and undoing them in various ways, he wrote, in an attempt to order the alternative modes of undoing. A shopkeeper was robbed at night. He resisted, was beaten in the head, was left alone, eventually died before robbery was noticed. A head-on collision between two cars, each attempting to overtake under conditions of restricted visibility. A man had a heart attack, tried in vain to reach the phone. Someone is killed by a stray shot in a hunting accident. How do you undo those, he wrote. And Kennedy's assassination, World War II. He went on for 8 neatly written pages. Imagination wasn't a flight with limitless destinations. It was a tool for making sense of a world of infinite possibilities by reducing them. The imagination obeyed rules, the rules of undoing. One rule was that the more items there were to undo in order to create some alternative reality, the less likely the mind was to undo them. People seemed less likely to undo someone being killed by a massive earthquake than they were to undo a person's being killed by a bolt of lightning, because undoing the earthquake required them to undo all the earthquake had done. The more consequences an event has, the the larger the change that is involved in eliminating that event, Danny wrote to Amos. Another related rule was that an event becomes gradually less changeable as it recedes into the past. With the passage of time, the consequences of any event accumulated and left more to undo, and the more there is to undo, the less likely the mind is to even try. This was perhaps one way time heals wounds, by making them feel less avoidable. A more general rule Danny labeled the focus rule. We tend to have a hero or an actor operating in a situation, he wrote. Wherever possible, we'll keep the situation fixed and have the actor move. We don't invent a gust of wind to deflect Oswald's bullet. An exception to this rule was when the person engaged in the undoing was the main actor of his own fantasy. He was less likely to undo his own actions than he was to undo the situation in which he found himself. Changing or replacing oneself is much less available than changing or replacing another actor, wrote Danny. A world in which I have a new set of traits must be very far from the world in which I live. I may have some freedom, but I am not free to be someone else. The most important general rule of undoing had to do with what was surprising or unexpected. A middle-aged banker takes the same route to work every day. One day he takes a different route and is killed when a drugged-out kid in a pickup truck runs a red light and sideswipes his car. Ask people to undo the tragedy, and their minds drift to the route the banker took that day. If only he had gone the usual way. But put that same man back on his normal route and let him be killed by the same drugged-out boy in the same truck, running a different stoplight, and no one thought, if only he had taken a different route that day. The distance the mind needed to travel from the usual way of doing things to some less ordinary way of doing things felt further than the trip made from the other direction. In undoing some event, the mind tended to remove whatever felt surprising or unexpected, which was different from saying that it was obeying the rules of probability. A far more likely way to spare the man was to alter his timing. If he or the boy had been just a few seconds faster or slower at any moment on their tragic journeys, they'd never have collided. When undoing the accident, people didn't think of that. It was easier to undo the unusual part of the story. You may amuse yourself by mentally undoing Hitler, Danny wrote, then mentioned to Amos a recent history that imagined Hitler having succeeded in his original ambition to be a painter in Vienna. Now imagine another counterfactual, wrote Danny. Simply remember that just prior to the instant of conception, there was a better than even chance that Adolf Hitler would be a lady. The probability of his being a successful artist was perhaps never so high as the better than 50-50 chance that he would be born a girl. Why then do we find one of these approaches to undoing Hitler quite acceptable, and the other shocking, almost ungrammatical? The workings of the imagination reminded Danny of cross-country skiing, which he tried and failed to take up in Vancouver. He'd taken the beginner's course twice, and discovered mainly how much more effort it took to climb some hill than to ski down it. The mind also preferred to go downhill when it was engaged in undoing. The downhill rule, Danny called this. As he worked out this new idea, he had a new feeling of having gone fast and far without Amos. At the end of his letter, he wrote, "It would help a lot if you could spend a couple of hours writing me a letter about this before we meet next Sunday." Danny wouldn't recall if Amos ever wrote that letter. Most likely he didn't. Amos seemed interested in Danny's new ideas, but for some reason, he didn't contribute to them. He had little to say, which was rare for Amos, said Danny. He suspected that Amos was wrestling with unhappiness, which was also unlike Amos. After he left Israel, Amos would later confide in a close friend he was surprised by how little guilt he felt, and also by how much homesickness. Maybe that was the problem. Maybe Amos, having formally immigrated to the United States, wasn't feeling himself. Or maybe the problem was how different these new ideas felt from their other work. Their work, until then, had always started as a challenge to some existing, widely accepted theory. They exposed the flaws and theories of human behavior and created other, more persuasive theories. There was no general theory of the human imagination to disprove. There was nothing to destroy or really even to push up against. There was another problem. The dramatic new difference in their relative status was coming between them. When Amos visited the University of British Columbia, he seemed to be lowering himself. Danny went up to Palo Alto and Amos came down to Vancouver.
Amos was a contemptuous person, and I could sense how provincial he thought the place was, said Danny.
One night, as they talked, Amos blurted out that the difference he felt being at Stanford was the difference of being in a place where everyone was first rate.
That was a first, recalled Danny. I knew he really did not mean a thing by it, and that he probably regretted saying it, but I remember the thought that it was simply inevitable that Amos would feel some condescending pity, and that I would be hurt by it.
But Danny's overwhelming feeling was of frustration. He'd gone the better part of a decade having all his ideas more or less in Amos's presence. There was no time at all between the moment either of them had some idea and the moment he shared it with the other. The magic was what happened next, the uncritical acceptance, the joining together of their minds.
I have a feeling that I initiate a lot, but the product is always out of my reach, Danny would one day tell Miles Shore.
Now he was back to working alone, sensing an absence of thoughts that would improve his own.
I was having an enormous number of ideas, but he wasn't there, said Danny, and so those ideas were wasted because they didn't have the benefit of the kind of thinking that Amos was capable of putting into things.
A few months after Danny wrote his memo to Amos in April 1979, he and Amos delivered a pair of talks at the University of Michigan. The occasion was the prestigious annual Katz Newcomb Lecture Series, and the striking thing about it, to Danny, was that both of them had been invited, not just Amos. Danny's impression that Amos might be feeling low on new ideas was confirmed when Amos took for the subject of his talk their joint work on framing. Danny's was his first public unveiling of ideas he had cooked up in their 9 months apart. The psychology of possible worlds, he called it. Because we feel ourselves to be among friends, he began, Amos and I have decided on what otherwise would be a risky choice for this lecture, a topic that we have only recently begun to study and about which we will still have much more enthusiasm than we have knowledge. We shall explore the role of unrealized possibilities in our emotional response to reality and in our understanding of it. He then explained the rules of undoing. He had created more vignettes to test on subjects. In addition to a banker who was killed in a car crash by a drugged-out boy, there was another unlucky man who had died of both a heart attack and from failing to hit the brakes on his car. Most of them he'd dreamed up late at night in Vancouver. He'd been awakened so often by his thoughts on the subject that he'd kept a notepad by his bed. Amos might be the superior mind, but Danny was the better talker. Amos might be getting the lion's share of the rewards of their relocation to North America, but that couldn't last forever. People would see his contribution. The audience was enthralled. He could see that. And when he was done, no one was in a hurry to leave. They were standing around together, and Amos's old mentor, Clyde Coombs, approached them with genuine wonder in his eyes.
"The ideas, so many ideas, where do they come from?" he asked.
And Amos said, "Danny and I don't talk about these things."
Danny and I don't talk about these things. That was the moment when the story unspooling in Danny's mind began to change. Later he would point to it and say, "That is the beginning of the end of us." He would later seek to undo the moment, but when he did not say, "If only Clyde Coombs had not asked that question," or, "If only I felt as invulnerable as Amos," or, "If only I had never left Israel." He said, "If only Amos was capable of self-effacement." Amos was the actor in Danny's imagination. Amos was the object in focus. Amos had been handed on a platter a chance to give Danny credit for what he had done, and Amos had declined to take it. They'd move on, but the moment had lodged itself in Danny's mind and would refuse to leave it.
"Something happens when you are with a woman you love," said Danny. "You know something happened. You know it's not good, but you go on. You are in love, and yet you sense a new force pulling you out of it. Your mind has lit upon the possibility of another narrative. You half hope something comes along to stabilize or re-energize the old one. In this case, nothing came along." I wanted Amos to lean back against what was happening, and he was not doing it.
"Nor did he accept that he had to do it," said Danny.
After Michigan, Danny gave talks about the Undoing Project and neglected to mention Amos. He'd never done that sort of thing before. For a decade, they had had a hard and fast rule against inviting others anywhere near areas of mutual interest. At the end of 1979, or perhaps in early 1980, Danny began to talk to a young assistant professor at UBC named Dale Miller, sharing his ideas about the way people compared reality to its alternatives. When Miller asked about Amos, Danny said that they were no longer working together. "He was in Amos's shadow, and he was very worried about that, I think," said Miller. It wasn't long before Danny and Miller were working on a paper together that might just as well have been called the Undoing Project. "I thought that they had agreed to see other people," said Miller, and he was insistent that his days of collaborating with Amos were over. "I remember a lot of fraught conversations. At some point, he said to be gentle with him, because this was his first relationship after Amos." If the Katz-Newcomb lecture meant less to Amos than to Danny, it was because Amos's life was now a sprint from one Katz-Newcomb lecture to the next. He reminded at least one of his new graduate students at Stanford of a stand-up comic, traveling the world and working small nightclubs to test his material. He thought by talking, recalled his wife Barbara, you could hear him in the shower, you could hear him talking to himself, through the door. His children grew used to hearing their father alone in a room, talking. It was a little bit like an insane person talking to himself, said his son Tal. They'd see him coming home in his brown Honda, stopping and starting in the street in front of their house and talking. He'd be going 3 miles an hour, then all of a sudden he'd gun it, said his daughter Donna. He'd worked out the idea. In the weeks leading up to the Katz-Newcomb lecture in early April 1979, Amos was busy talking to the Soviet Union. He'd joined a delegation of 10 prominent Western psychologists on a bizarre intellectual diplomatic mission. Soviet psychologists were then trying to persuade their government to admit mathematical psychology into the Russian Academy of Sciences, and had asked their American counterparts for support. Two distinguished mathematical psychologists, William Estes and Duncan Luce, had taken it upon themselves to help them. The older guys made a short list of America's leading mathematical psychologists. Most of them were ancient. Amos counted as one of the younger guys, along with his Stanford colleague Brian Wandell. The older guys had this idea that we were going to rescue the image of psychology in the Soviet Union, recalled Wandell. Psychology flew in the face of Marxism. It was on the list of things that didn't need to exist. It took about a day to realize why Marxism might feel that way. These particular Soviet psychologists were charlatans. We were thinking there really were going to be scientists on the Soviet end, said Wandell. There weren't. The Soviets and the Americans took turns giving presentations. An American would give a learned talk about decision theory. His Soviet counterpart would rise and offer a talk that sounded completely insane. One guy spent his allotted time on his theory about how the brain waves caused by beer canceled the brain waves caused by vodka. We'd get up and give a paper, and you know, it was okay, said Wandell. Then some Russian guy would get up and talk, and we'd say, wow, that was weird. One was about how the meaning of life could be put into a formula, and the formula might have some variable labeled E in it. With one exception, the Russians knew nothing about decision theory and didn't even seem particularly interested in the subject. There was one guy, said Wandell, who gave this great talk, at least compared to the others. That guy turned out to be a KGB agent whose training in psychology consisted of the talk he had given. The way we discovered he was a KGB guy was that he showed up later at a physics conference and gave a great talk there, too, said Wandell. That was the only guy Amos liked. They stayed at a hotel where the toilets didn't flush and the heat didn't work. Their rooms were bugged, and everywhere they went, they were followed by guards. People were pretty freaked out the first day or two, said Wandell. We were plainly in over our heads. Amos found the whole thing hysterical. They put a focus on Amos, probably because he was Israeli, said Wandell. In typical Amos fashion, he was walking around Red Square and gives me this look that says, come on, let's lose him. Then he just kind of took off with the guards chasing after him. When they finally caught up to him, hiding in a department store, the Soviets were furious. They gave us all a stern talking to, said Wandell. Amos spent at least some of his time in his bugged and heatless hotel room, adding to a file that he'd labeled the Undoing Project. The file in the end came to 40 or so pages of handwritten notes. Between the lines, you can hear the polite throat clearing of a diamond cutter waiting for his rocks. Amos clearly had hopes of turning Danny's ideas into a full-blown theory. Danny didn't know that, or that Amos was busy dreaming up his own vignettes. David P. was killed in a plane crash. Which of the following is easier to imagine? That the plane did not crash? or that David P. took another plane. Instead of replying to Danny's long letter, Amos made notes to himself, trying to order the stuff spilling out of Danny. The present world is often surprising, that is, less plausible than some of its alternatives, he wrote. We can order possible worlds by, one,